Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Friday, April 28th, and let the record reflect it is 1:05 p.m. Today we have present Representative Groh, Representative Eastman, Representative Gray, Vice Chair Allard, and myself, Chair Vance. I would like to remind committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. Today we the staff assisting us is Sophia Tenney with House Records and Talia Ames from the Juneau LIO. On today's agenda, the committee will hear House Bill 29, Insurance Discrimination, by Representative McCabe in its first hearing, and then the committee will open up public testimony for House Bill 181, State Commission for Civil Rights. So we'll now take up House Bill 29, Insurance Discrimination, and I'd like to welcome to the table Representative McCabe and his staff, Buddy Witt. If you could please place your names on the record and begin your bill presentation.
Good afternoon, Chair Vance and members of the House Judiciary Committee. Thank you for hearing House Bill 29. For the record, I'm Kevin McCabe, representative for House District 30. With me, I have my staff buddy Witt here at the table. This is a bill introduction for HB 29. Insurance companies are in the business of discrimination at the bottom of the whole pile. They segregate the insured into separate risk pools based on their differences in risk profiles for two main reasons: so that they can charge different premiums to the different groups based on their risk, and to incentivize risk reduction by the insured. There are, however, limits to the type of discrimination that insurers can engage in. Those discrimination restriction decisions are decided at the national and at the local levels of government, and laws on discrimination and intensity of regulation vary a great deal in each jurisdiction. Insurance companies have been denying coverage to Alaskans based solely on their political affiliation, expression, and/or elected status. This bill seeks to prohibit insurance discrimination based solely on those factors. Specifically, House Bill 29 amends the insurance code in Alaska from using political expression, affiliation, or status as a public official as the sole reason to refuse to insure or refuse to renew insurance coverage, limit the scope of insurance coverage, cancel an existing insurance policy, deny a claim covered by an existing insurance policy, or increase the premium, policy fees, or rates charged on an insurance policy. I'd like to emphasize this point. This bill would not prohibit refusals, limitations, or fees that are based on sound underwriting or actuarial principles. Given that insurance products are necessary to protecting health and property, and in some instances required by law, I believe that it is in the public interest to ensure that consumers are protected from discriminatory practices. I believe that House Bill 29 helps in that effort. Again, thanks for the opportunity to present HB 29, and I appreciate the committee's support. For discussion, we have the following invited testifiers: Buddy Witt, my staff in person. He'll take you through the sectional if you desire. And Greg Smith from the Division of Insurance in the room, or Ms. Winghire in the room to answer any questions from committee members. Again, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. Mr. Witt, please walk us through a sectional.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Buddy Witt, staff to Representative McCabe. I'm going to try to be as quick as possible, and I can come back to the table, but I want to inform the chair and committee members that Ms. Winghire is on a very tight timeline today. She probably will not be able to stay all until 1:30, and I know we were slightly delayed today. So I will briefly go through this sectional, and then I might just step aside in case there are questions for the committee, if that's the chair's wish. Madam Chair, I wanted to also, as I go through this sectional, I want to talk a little bit about the changes that were made in the previous committee of referral. They made slight changes to the bill that I want to identify. Section 1 of the current iteration of the bill, this is version S. Section 1 amends AS21.36 to add a new section that prohibits a person transacting in insurance from discriminating against a person based solely on their political affiliation or expression, or a person's status as an elected official, or their membership in a political party as defined in AS 1580-010. This section was changed in Labor and Commerce to to put in the specify a person's elected position and to specify the party and then give the reference to AS 1580010. In 2022, a bill was passed in the legislature making some changes to how we designate political parties. Basically, it was a Senate bill that passed that said a political party is an association of 5,000 people. We will, and then the state will reevaluate every 10 years after the census. And then, based upon changes in the population, percentage of changes in the population, that percentage would be put on that that threshold, rounded to the nearest 500. So basically, we're taking that that definition of a political party, inserting it in this bill to say that discrimination based on political party membership would be against the law. And then Section 2 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska by adding a new section regarding the applicability. So the applicability of this statute occurs on policies after the effective date, after this bill is signed into the law. So there's no grandfathering provision. And the other item I wanted to mention was we specified in Section 1 in version S of the bill. This was another change that was made in the previous committee, Labor and Commerce, specified we specified the elected official. So this would be on page 2 of the bill, starting with line 3, or line 4, I should say. The elected official means specifically a member of the legislature, the governor, the lieutenant governor, a constitutional convention delegate, a borough or city mayor, or a member of a borough or city assembly council or school board. Those specifications were added in the previous committee as well. And that's the analysis of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. Since we have Ms. Wienyard for a short amount of time, I would like to invite her to the table for any questions that members may have. I apologize. Do you have invited testimony about the bill before we open for questions?
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Lori Wing-Heyer. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the state. I do not have any public testimony, but I'd be happy to take any questions of where this bill came from and why it's being presented by Representative McCabe.
Representative Groh.
I'm very interested as to what actual instances we've had that has prompted this bill. Jenny, I just would like to learn about the history and genesis.
Certainly. Through the chair, Representative Groh, Representative McCabe approached me about this bill that he was putting it in, and I had not heard of elected officials being denied insurance because of their elected status, but I frequently, as the director, have conversations with the independent agents and brokers, and they confirmed to me that this is, in fact, happening. And it is, and in our discussions, he had, I believe the original bill was state officials, and they talked about it doesn't matter if you're a school board member in Homer or a borough member in Mat-Su, there are instances where they cannot get insurance. I could not find anything in reference to political party. I'm not doubting that it's happened. I just could find no reference, but most definitely because of elected status. Excess liability was denied because of being an elected official in this state.
I just have never heard this before. It seems entirely commercially illogical. And whatever you could tell me about, you know, the nature of the problem and the apparent cause, I would be very interested in learning. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Through the chair, again, Representative Groh, there's not much more to it than that. When the bill was presented, I did some research with the agents and brokers, and a few insurance companies confirmed that, yes, their underwriting guidelines do not permit underwriting, particularly excess liability, of public officials. And this was new to me. As much as it is to you today, it was when I first discussed it with Representative McCabe.
So, Representative Groh, thank you. Through the chair, we know it. Director Wing-Heyer calls it excess liability. You and I know it as an umbrella policy. So we can still get insurance as elected officials, but certain companies, if you are an elected official, and it happened to me, and it's since been confirmed, at least one school board member and one other person in this legislature who asked not to be identified have been denied umbrella policies because they were an elected official. So in my case, I went to the insurance company and I said, I'd like to get an umbrella policy. And they said, what do you do? And I said, well, I've been elected to the, I'm a pilot, but I've been elected to the Alaska State Legislature. And their answer was, well, I'm sorry, we can't give you an umbrella policy. So I hesitate to name any names of companies or anything like that, but I asked around.
Did anybody ever say why? Or I'm just really interested in this because, yes.
Through the chair, Representative Grow, insurance companies look at the risk overall, as I'm sure you're aware, and when you're an elected official or a superstar, they see you as a target for getting sued. And I believe that that is what their basis was on, that you're an elected official, there's notoriety, some are more well-known than others, but they don't know that sitting in Seattle or Omaha, wherever they're underwriting. They just see that you're an elected official. And because you are, you're probably more well-known and probably thought maybe to have more means. And they don't want to pay the claims because of it being a public official.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I would just like to clarify for the record, for the public listening, just because we are elected officials, that we are very likely to not be of means. Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. And I want to put on the record, I've had this happen to me. I haven't talked to Representative McKay about it through the chair. I apologize. And it was an umbrella policy. I was shocked. I did end up finding some sort of coverage. It wasn't what I was looking for, and it was disheartening. They didn't give me a reason why. I fully believe it was discrimination, whether it was based on my political party or just the fact that I'm a politician. Either way, it was discriminatory, and it blew me out of the water. You're there to have a policy because you want to protect your family. It's when you're gone or something happens, you're looking to protect your family. And I will speak an experience that, yes, I could be potentially a target like anybody else in this room, especially during these hostile times in our country. So, Representative McKay, thank you.
McCabe.
Oh, dear Lord. Sorry. That caucus. There you go. Thanks, McCabe.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I did not know what excess liability insurance was or umbrella insurance. I don't have it. I mean, I guess my first question is, do all elected officials need to be purchasing this type of insurance?
Through the chair, Representative Gribe, I can't tell you what to purchase or not, but I can tell you that this is a very litigious society, days that we're living in. And when your homeowners has a limit of $500,000 or your auto insurance is $5,100, the minimum of the state, that is probably not going to take you very far if there were to be a claim against you that where you were found negligent as the property owner, as the owner of the automobile, whatever could happen. And it is becoming more and more common for people to buy the higher limits because they're inexpensive. You can get an extra $5 million on top of your homeowners for $500, $600 a year. So relatively speaking, they're not expensive, but in today's litigious society, we're very much seeing a take up on excess liability.
Yes. So I've only been an elected official for a few months, but there's already been some issues that have come up, but because of Article 2, Section 6 of the Alaska State Constitution, which provides legislative immunity, my understanding was that I couldn't be sued for anything that I did in this body and 5 days of travel going to and from. And then I also did some research, looked into this, and we're also protected by the federal constitution as part of the speech and debate clause of Article 1 of the Constitution. And they talked about how that's actually extended beyond the legislative to actually protect some mayors, and it's been used in that way. So I guess this is a long way of saying that maybe I was under false impression that the Constitution of the State of Alaska and the federal constitution gave me some legislative immunity to not be sued for things that I do or say as a legislator.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, you do have some legislative immunity, but as outside of your role as an individual, outside of your role as a representative, you're not protected by that immunity. So if you were driving your personal car and there were to be a horrific accident and it had nothing to do in your capacity as an elected member of this body, you could be held liable.
But wouldn't anyone who is driving their car recklessly and caused an accident need to be held liable? I'm not understanding. Thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair Allard. I'm not understanding.
I'm sorry.
Representative McCabe.
So through the chair, Representative Gray, I specifically was looking for it because I own a section of property. And when I first moved out there, I was the only one out there. We built a home, 40 acres. The majority of the road leading into this area is on an easement that's on my property. And as it started to build up with people with families and kids and dirt bikes, I suddenly realized that I wasn't really covered for that road, which was on a legal easement. But if the teenagers got out there on their bike and they were not going to and from their home, I'm covered if they're just going to and from their home. But if they're out there riding, or it could be friends of theirs that are riding their motorcycles that they're not going to and from their home, that are not residents of that home, I just felt like I didn't have enough coverage without getting a big, huge, expanded homeowner policy. The easiest thing to do was to get an umbrella policy, and that's kind of the genesis of this whole thing. When I moved out there, there was one family. Now there's eight, and all their relatives and friends and all that kind of stuff. So lots more activity, lots more dirt bikes, ATVs, that kind of thing. So I didn't get it. I wasn't looking for it specifically because I'd been elected. I was looking for it for other reasons.
Follow up.
So were you denied? Did they say that you were denied because you were an elected official? They said they don't cover elected officials.
That's correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'd like to let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Johnson at 121.
My apologies, Madam Chair.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, it occurs to me as I'm listening to the conversation, the member to my left may not be aware of this because he does not currently represent a conservative district. I think that might be a different perspective. I just wanted to share, for the benefit of the committee, just one of the messages I received the last 24 hours. It says, "Hi, why don't you kill yourself? Please do. Come on. Kill yourself. Put an end to your misery, you undeserving piece of expletive. You are not worth the life you have, you muck. You're less than an animal, expletive, end your life." Perhaps if the member representing my district, he might be more aware of the fact that insurance in my district is not optional. It just isn't. And I would also mention, just to point it on the other side, you know, there was a member of our body whose home was broken into, that we heard about this week, who was certainly not from a conservative district. But regardless, insurance hopefully would cover that type of thing. But when that member goes to renew their insurance, I suspect that the insurance company is going to be asking more questions and wondering if the theft that she experienced had to do with her being in public office. Since I've been in the body, we've had legislators whose cars have had their tires slashed and other things, and insurance companies, I'm sure, will, you know, want to not incur additional risk by, you know, putting out a policy for a legislator who is more likely than the average person to either be a victim of having their tires slashed or their home robbed, or some other, you know, threats on their person, which necessitate higher risk. So just want to add that perspective.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just like to call your attention to the time, and Ms. Winghire is need to go, so.
Thank you for that. Do we have any further questions for Ms. Winghire? Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. I don't have any more for you. First of all, I wanted to apologize to Representative McGray. That's not what I meant. And forget sometimes we're on hot mic no matter what in this room. With the umbrella insurance, through the chair, with the umbrella insurance, I do appreciate you being here, because when I did a test, sort of like McCabe had done, Representative McCabe, and I asked my husband to call, and lo and behold, he got an umbrella insurance, and I was unable to. It's important that we are treated the same. So thank you for being here. Thank you, Representative McCabe.
Representative Groh.
I guess, through the chair, the only point that I would make is that if you've spent years litigating like I have during my life, you're well aware that there is often a difference between, on the one hand, somebody's legal rights, and on the other hand, the actual reason they're asserting them. And so I would just say that, although I'd never previously known about this problem, I appreciate Representative McKay bringing it to my attention. That's all I have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Winghire, one last question. Does this cover all types of insurance?
Madam Chair, yes, it will.
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
We will let you run out to your next appointment.
Thank you, Director.
Thank you.
So we've, Representative McCabe, you've touched on the elected official status, but can you speak to the political party portion of this and the need for it in the bill as well?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative McCabe, initially when we had it drafted, it said political affiliation. In Labor and Commerce, it was amended to say by another representative who felt that it needed to be tightened up because political affiliation is a broader term. So they put the amendment in there as political party. And frankly, it's I don't know that it's all that necessary in there. However, I could see maybe a Alaska Independent Party person or somebody that's not, to be under this same sort of issue, somebody that actually is a well-known party name, maybe even some radical party, some that we don't agree with, that's a well-known party name, maybe even a national name, being unable to get umbrella insurance because of their affiliation. They might not be elected, but they are affiliated with a party. Some of the folks on the Kenai that you're aware of come to mind that might, if their name is recognized when they call for insurance, it might be an issue. So that was the reason for that inclusion. So
thank you, Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. And I wanted to also bring up through the chair is I watched my premium skyrocket. I was with the company for almost 30 years, same company. I actually had to leave them because my insurance tripled with no reasonable explanation. And I would say that had to do with political party. And I've also had an insurance claim denied when somebody had hit me and the other party didn't want to pay for it. And it was definitely their fault. It was in the police report. And they point blank told me, you don't want this to go public. We know you don't want the press on it. So it was mind boggling of some of the things that have done and happened, just like happens to Representative Eastman, happens to Representative Gray, anybody in this room. It's not okay for any of us. So thank you, Chair.
Representative McCabe.
Madam Chair, if I might as well, with the legislature in Juneau and our time down here highly publicized and people of a more nefarious bent out there know if you're married or not married, if your house is vacant or not vacant, as we saw with a representative in the house that just got broken into, I think it's very dangerous. So you might be covered for normal theft or something like that, but what if somebody breaks into your house and then starts living there and you're down here for months at a time? Now they start inviting people in, maybe cooking meth or something like that, something that's outside the bounds of your normal insurance. I think an umbrella policy for us is of utmost importance. And anyways, you sort of reminded me, Representative Gray, of the issue with our friend and colleague on the floor. And I think this is imperative and will help to resolve that issue.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. So in my very basic research, there were certain things that they pointed out in the articles that I looked at where the Constitution, through the chair, this wouldn't cover, the Constitution wouldn't protect you. For example, if you made a defamatory statement against, for example, a constituent during a press conference, it says the Constitution doesn't cover you there. If you were as part of a committee, you illegally seize documents. The Constitution does not cover you there. But I'm curious, would these umbrella policies, if you got sued for making a defamatory statement against a constituent and they sued you and you lost, would the umbrella policy pay for the damages? I'm curious about that.
Yeah, I'm not real sure through the chair. I'm not sure of that. Of course, that was a question for Ms. Winghire. And I think it depends on the policy that you get. But what it probably would pay, may not pay the damages, but it would pay most likely for the attorney fees. And that's typically what an umbrella policy will help cover automatically. I don't know, maybe Representative Groh as a lawyer knows more about damages and that sort of stuff, but I can ask Director Winghire and get the answer to you, or perhaps Mr. Witt has a better.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I was just going to offer to find that information for you and share it with you through the chair.
Representative Groh.
I think often I understand Representative Gray's concerns about defamation claims. Often the bigger risks or bigger concerns arise in the context, as Representative McKay, Director Ringhire was discussing before, things like automobile accidents or injuries on property, as Representative McKay.
Representative Groh, I just ask that all of us speak into our mics a little bit better. Thank you.
I'll work on it. Thank you.
Perfect. Mr. Witt.
Madam Chair, can I add one little piece to the question? Kind of actually ties into Representative Groh's question regarding the litigation piece and then also the previous question regarding the addition of parties. Pointing to the original iteration of this bill, we used words like affiliation and expression. And it kind of was, this came together in labor in the previous committee on labor and commerce, the question of litigation kind of brought forward the amendment to add party so that we could tighten up the language and specify what we were talking about. And so when we took out expression and affiliation, because to some it seemed ambiguous language, where if you took that ambiguous language, and this relates directly to the Judiciary Committee, you take ambiguous language and you litigate it, you don't know what you're going to come out with. So the idea was to tighten up the bill and specify what type of discrimination we were talking about or to whom. And I think that's what those two amendments, the bill sponsor looked at those two amendments as friendly because it tightened up that language, I believe. But it gets to where we're trying to be, but there was a thorough discussion about expression, as in a certain bumper sticker, flag, etc. Could there be discrimination based upon that type of expression? But unfortunately, we didn't get to a place where we thought the language was tight enough to get us through litigation. I think is kind of where we were discussion in the previous committee, but it certainly is an area of the Judiciary Committee wants to discuss that further.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. Any further questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Eastman.
Thanks. Yeah, and just to make sure they're on the record, so the reference to political affiliation now changed to political party, is that because of specific instances that have already happened, or is that in anticipation of incidents that might happen in the future?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, Representative Eastman, it was just future incidences. We envisioned, as divisive as the country, as polarized as we seem to have become, we envisioned, like Mr. Witt said, bumper stickers, flags, that sort of thing. But when you're issuing a policy from Washington or Oregon or wherever, you don't necessarily know that somebody has a Democrat or Republican bumper sticker on their car, so it would be hard for them to do it. So party, they can determine by looking you up, right? I mean, they can look up your voter rec at the insurance company and determine your party. So the party made sense to me, just tightening it up a little bit.
Follow-up? I see here on line 11 of page 1, it talks about the increase of premiums and so forth. Is the scope of this bill dealing with new policies that haven't been applied for before, or increases to current policies, or increases to new policies, or all of the above?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it's Representative McCabe for the record. We envisioned all of those, keeping in mind, as I said in my sponsor statement, that insurance companies discriminate. If you're a bad driver and you have 6 accidents, your policy rates are going to go up, and that's allowed. But what we are saying is we don't want them to discriminate or raise your rates exorbitantly. We understand that legislators get sued, public figures get sued. We understand that there may be some sort of an increase, but we just didn't want them to limit the policies or make the price increase too much just because you are an elected official. So they have actuarial tables where they can determine the price if you have 6 accidents or 7 accidents and the difference in your automobile price for that. They should have the same for if you're a legislator or not a legislator. And they shouldn't raise your rates more than their actuarial tables say they should, if you will.
Well, all right. So trying to get more clarity on that. So if you have a legislator, for example, a legislator from Fairbanks, we'll use that as an example because it's current, who is a victim of theft. And maybe before the first instance, they had a normal policy like everybody else, but once they've had, you know, a theft or a car accident, you know, someone without insurance is engaged in a car accident with them because they're politically affiliated or something. Would this bill allow the insurance company to then take into account the fact that they had their home broken into or they, you know, were a victim of this car accident and then jack up their rates accordingly based on the fact that, you know, it's now more likely that they'll be a victim of a future theft or a future car accident?
I think I'll let Mr. Witt seems to think he has an answer to that one.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, just want to make sure we're talking about if this bill should pass, an elected official has something happen, they go to renew their policy, and the policy, the premiums, whatever, either they're denied or the premium goes up, harking back. So the bill basically says, through the chair again, Buddy Witt, for the record, the bill basically says there's still a level of proof. The insurance company has to say if they do increase the premium or refuse to renew a policy based upon something other than a person's status as an elected official, and if they are challenged on that, they would still have a certain threshold of proof of the why. And if it's only because of their status as an elected official, the bill would say that is against the law. I'll also point to the applicability section, and I want to say this is nothing is grandfathered into this policy bill. This has to do with insurance policies that are issued, delivered, or renewed after the effective date. So for anyone who is currently an elected person or fits any of the descriptions in the bill, if they are currently under an insurance policy, then if this bill was enacted and once the bill comes into law, hopefully, if they go to renew and they're denied because they are currently an elected person, that too would be against the law. However, that's the way I read it because we're looking at a new renewal. I hope that answers your question. That's just my reading of the bill.
Representative McCabe.
Well, thank you. Through the chair. So, Representative Eastman, it's a really good question, and it's a fair point that Mr. Witt makes, is there is no retroactive clause in this bill. So if there is somebody that's currently under litigation and this bill's enacted into law and the insurance company says, okay, there's a new law, we'll give you a policy right now, whatever happened in the past is in the past. You don't get to you know, say, well, and that's an insurance company deal. They're not going to pay for something in the past. So.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I can envision a hypothetical legislator who might get sued a lot. And I think I'm wondering, I could see how an insurance company wouldn't want to insure that individual who was, you know, repeatedly making defamatory statements at press conferences. But I could also see how with this bill, you would say, well, if they weren't an elected official, they wouldn't be doing press conferences. So it becomes sort of related to their being an elected official. But I could see how that there should be some sort of release. If they're sued five times, then the sixth time, they're no longer covered. And I'm just curious if there's any thought about this hypothetical legislator who is going to push the envelope.
Sure. So through the chair, Representative Gray, it's sort of like I can see the insurance company raising the rates on somebody who drives horribly and gets in big, you know, a great number of accidents. That's an explainable incident where somebody can't control their mouth or they continue to do this. Then the insurance company has every right to say, wait a minute, they've been sued six times. We absolutely need to cover our bases. Just like if your teenager gets in an accident, and, you know, six accidents, now we need to raise your rates to cover our bases. This bill only contemplates a much higher rate or no issuance at all, solely based on your status as an elected official, not on the number of lawsuits that you've had against you.
Madam Chair, if I may, through the chair, Representative Gray, just to add on to that, I would point to the bill, page 1, starting on line 13. The provisions of A of this section do not apply if the refusal, limitation, cancellation, denial, or increase is based on sound underwriting or actuarial principles reasonably related to actual or anticipated loss experience. So it's not a complete, you get whatever insurance policy you want forever as long as you're an elected official. It has to be solely based on just your status as an elected official. If that's the only reason that you are denied, this bill says it's against the law. If you're an elected official and you keep doing, let me watch my words. If you're an elected official and you keep creating liability for yourself, and the insurance company, through sound actuarial principles, can point to that liability as a reason to either increase your current policy or not enter into a new policy with you, that is sound actuarial principle. It is covered under the law.
Follow up.
And I know this is kind of a weird question, but through the chair, have any insurance companies weighed in on this bill? And do they feel that that's enough? And I know it's a weird question because I would imagine that most insurance companies wouldn't want this. But I'm just curious.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, the bill sponsor's office has not received any letters either in support of or opposed to the piece of legislation.
I'd like to let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Carpenter at 1:42 p.m.
And if you will, Madam Chair. So in answer to your question, through the chair, Representative Gray, absolutely. The insurance companies are in the business of limiting their risk as well. That's their business. So I would envision the same as you, that they would not be too happy about it. We discussed it at great length with Director Winghire about the number of insurance companies that provide umbrella policies in the state of Alaska. And when we talked to her, there is enough that if one of them decided not to insure in the state of Alaska because of this law, it would not materially affect the rest of Alaskans. For reference, our representative that's owns a construction company says there's only two that will insure his construction company, and yet there's a dozen at least that provide umbrella policies in the state of Alaska. So we felt that the risk to the average Alaskan, and I don't think there's that many umbrella policies issued anyways, we felt the risk was minimal to bring this forward. The rewards would be better than the risk. So,
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. So to step back for a moment, would you believe that it's it should be allowed for an insurance industry to discriminate based on age.
So, through the chair, I believe if they are following their actuarial principles, I mean, if you know, we're way off the subject of this bill, but if you look at, say, a term life insurance company, you know, if you're 55 years old, your price is going to be higher than if you're 20 years old. And that's, I believe, what's covered when we call a sound actuarial principle, because a 20-year-old has a much healthier lifestyle, probably less medical issues, less, you know, of an opportunity to maybe not react quick enough and get in an accident or that sort of thing. The insurance companies have huge, huge actuarial data and database for what they do. So I don't know that it's called discrimination, no more than it's discrimination if I get a great policy because I drive 55 and wear a seatbelt and you don't get a great car policy because you're a speed demon and you don't wear a seatbelt, and if that makes sense. There is a certain level of discrimination in any insurance company in what they do, and a certain amount of it is allowed. We're just, with this bill, saying that if it's discriminated solely based on your election or your status as an elected official, that's incorrect.
Well, so are you only asking for an insurance company to be able to point towards some news articles or other data that's going to be able to say, wow, you know, it's obvious that among the whole population of people, if you're an elected official, you have a somewhat higher, you know, likelihood of either ending up in court or, you know, having some type of injury or something that's going to result in an insurance claim. Because it sounded like from what you were just arguing that wouldn't necessarily be discrimination if, you know, it's based on actual, you know, experience or evidence somewhere. And it would seem to me it's not that difficult to find plenty of examples. I mean, I could point to the four legislators just in the legislature here that have been sued within the last couple of years, amongst them you and I both. So it should be pretty easy to demonstrate that as an insurance adjuster, I would think.
Certainly, and through the chair, if I may, I absolutely think that an umbrella insurance policy for a legislator will be more expensive than for somebody who you know, has a general job and just drives back and forth to their job and doesn't do what you and I do. I totally expect that it will cost more for a legislator. But to have them say you can't have one because you were recently elected or because you were elected, I think is wrong. If they had said to me and to others that I've talked to, yep, you're a legislator, we've done the actuarials, legislators get sued or elected officials get sued on this level, so this is what it's going to cost you, I think that would have been appropriate.
Thank you. Follow-up? Follow-up. Or if someone else is in the queue, go ahead.
Representative Carpenter, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My apologies for being late. And if this question's already been asked, then you can just tell me to seek out the record. I'm curious how it would be enforced. Like, how would you prove discrimination that was based solely upon politics? Would it be a written letter where they're stating specifically because you're an elected representative now, we will not write a new insurance, or is there some action that was taken that then would have to be proven in a court that was based on politics?
Through the chair, so Representative Carpenter, that's probably a director wing hire question for the most part. I believe that the Division of Insurance gets complaints all the time from people that are complaining about insurance companies or their coverage or their denial, possibly a letter. I was told point blank on the phone, I'm sorry, I can't sell you this policy because you are an elected official. So at that point, I would have called the director of insurance, and they actually have an enforcement capability with the insurance companies. I don't know exactly what that is, and that's probably a better question for her. But
hello, Miss, she was here the first half hour, had another appointment, so I apologize that she's not available.
I missed my opportunity. No further questions.
Representative Eastman, you had another follow-up, and then Representative Gray.
Appreciate that. Through the chair. actually, let me just let Representative Gray go first, and I'll reformulate my question.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. So, through the chair, this is kind of going back to the very beginning about what an umbrella policy covers. I guess just very basically, what is everything an umbrella policy covers? Or is that too big? I don't know. Okay, well, I don't know. I literally don't know what an umbrella policy is. I'm so sorry.
Representative Gray, as the question that I asked Ms. Wehire, is that this covers all types of insurance.
All types of insurance.
It says a person transacting insurance. So it's not just an umbrella policy.
Okay.
So it can be anything.
Okay. Follow up. Is it my duty when purchasing all types of insurance to disclose that I'm an elected official and therefore, I mean, and do they ask you that? Mm-hmm. When I get through the chair, follow up, I just did a new auto insurance policy and they did not ask me this. I didn't have to check a box that said that I was an elected official. Was that an unusual circumstance?
Representative McCabe.
So through the chair, probably not, because it's just a normal auto policy. The umbrella policy is the excess liability policy, which covers it over and above. So in my case, I think I was looking for a $3 million umbrella coverage, which covers my lawyers should I get sued, and covers those sorts, you know, that sort of thing. So a normal auto policy, I think it's sort of already covered with their actuarial tables, and you're not necessarily going to drive any different just because you've been elected official. So however you stand, according to them, a better chance of getting sued if you are an elected official, and they don't want to have to cover that. So,
Mr. Witt.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, you might have 59 other legislators asking which insurance company you use because they don't ask that question. But every insurance company, when they're issuing policies, they will ask different questions that fit their actuarial and risk model. For some insurance companies, for certain types of policies, that may not be something that they're interested in. Umbrella policy was the example given, but the bill sponsor and the chair are right. This is for all policies. And then getting back to the question Representative Carpenter asked, I will follow up with the Division of Insurance to make sure that I get an answer for the committee through the chair. But I believe that in the denial of a policy or the denial of a renewal of a policy or a significant increase in premiums with a policy to an elected official, the follow-up question should be, can I get an explanation for the denial or the increase, whatever it may be, and in writing? And once you have that explanation, then you would take whatever next step is appropriate. I will confirm that that is the case. And in a lot of cases, depending on the size of the policy, an insurance company will preemptively tell you why you were denied or why you have an increase. Usually why you were denied, haven't really seen any examples of an explanation for huge increases. So, but I'll get that information to the chair.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. I just wanted to add to the conversation about the types of insurance. We're talking about an umbrella policy. I think when you become an elected official or a public official in another capacity other than being elected, so it's like a CEO of a corporation or something like that, I think most times people seek after an errors and omissions liability policy. That means that if I'm doing something in the normal course of my business as that official, that I'm not breaking the law or going against company policy, that if I get sued, then there's a policy in place that's going to help with the cost, defer the cost or cover the cost of that. And it's usually called an errors and omissions policy. It has nothing to do with a auto policy.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And just to add to that previous conversation, I think it would be very odd if an insurance company did not ask at least your employment status. and generally who you are employed, you know, by or for, because that is kind of one of the more important metrics on most actuarial tables. Now, it may very well be when you do that, you know, you have some time you spend as a legislator, you got some time you spend in the National Guard or some other place where they don't necessarily tell you list all of the different places you work. So, you know, a lot of people will just put, you know, the one that they spend their most time of the year on or that they've had for the longest. And they may never be asked a specific question of, and also, you know, did you get elected? You know, I could definitely see how, you know, they may not go that, you know, depth. But if you put legislator down, then you're probably likely to trigger some additional questions and so forth. Follow up to the previous. So it would seem to me that there are two ways that we could, as a state, from a policy standpoint, handle the recognition that these CEOs, these commissioners, these elected officials have, you know, for whatever reason, incurred greater risk of being sued or being targeted or so forth. One of which is kind of like the bill here proposes would just be to say that insurance companies, you know, should be limited in what they can do. They can't simply say, well, we don't want to deal with those kind of policies, so, you know, don't apply here, go somewhere else. So we would be prohibiting them from taking that action, this bill. Another approach would be for the state to recognize, well, the people who are engaged in working for the state in these capacities as commissioners, as legislators, as governors, so forth, are incurring this additional responsibility. Maybe the state should bear the burden of that additional risk and liability. And I'm just wondering, why would we look to have the insurance company themselves bear that additional risk and what have you, when the state might be better situated to do that? I know that's a policy call. I don't see this in the bill. Have you thought about those two routes, and why, if so, why did you choose this route?
Sure, fair point. So through the chair, Representative Eastman, when I was initially applying for this, even though I had been elected, it wasn't the reason I was applying for it. So it seemed to me that just because you're elected official isn't the reason to be denied. I agree with you that I think the state maybe should be indemnifying. It's the governor. I know that a former governor had huge legal fees because she was sued a number of times. And so I get what you're saying, but that's, as you said, a policy call that would have to come from some other sort of bill. In this case, and in the two cases that I've talked to in the legislature and one in the school board, as I said, they weren't looking for umbrella policies because they were elected, but they were denied them because they were elected. So they were looking for them for other reasons. So,
thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, I think this has been a great first introduction, and I appreciate the ability to answer all the questions so well, and for having the Ms. Wingheyer here as well. We are going to set House Bill 29 aside, and again, thank you for the presentation, Representative McCabe and Mr. Witt.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Chair Vance.
For the second and final item on our agenda today, we will bring back House Bill 181, State Commission for Civil Rights. And I do give apologies to the public who has called in. We had canceled the hearing on the bill for today because, as discussed on Wednesday, there is further drafting as requested by the director that we need to do. But we do have people who had already prepared to give public testimony, so I'm going to open and hear public testimony in House Bill 181. And I will begin with Ms. Cheryl Bowie. If you have 2 minutes, if you could state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you for the opportunity to provide public testimony. My name is Cheryl Bowie, and I am an ANCSA shareholder. And I really like this HB 181, the civil rights bill. And I would just like to request that the ANCSA and tribal organizations and South Central Foundation or the Alaska Tribal Health Compact be included in this bill so we can start recognizing the diversity in our own culture and respecting other people's civil rights. Earlier in the year, there was an article in the news, in one of the news media things, about one of the Alaska Native leaders in a sensitive healthcare position that stated that they didn't have to respect our civil rights, and I find that really offensive. And I think that we need to move forward and create a set of laws that work in tandem instead of in conflict, so we can start moving forward in areas of civil rights and equal employment opportunity. And the bill currently states that you're going to be reviewing this and doing research on it. So I would just like you guys to include the Native corporations, and, you know, especially they make contracts with churches and they back political parties, and maybe those aren't outright civil rights violations, but those are decisions, you know, that we should make as individuals, and they should be respected. And the same thing with the executing research agreements without getting individual consent of the people in Alaska, just using the Native corporations' political savvy and ability to bend the law to gain access to our medical records without our individual consent. So I just think that those things should be reviewed. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Billy. We do have a question from Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Ms. Bowie.
Okay.
Thank you for your testimony today. I just wanted some clarification. You had said that somebody had said something about not respecting civil rights.
Yeah, it was an article that it was in, I believe, the Must Read Alaska. I just had it up a second ago, and it said that, let me see, the name of the article is Valerie Davidson says Native hospitals don't have to honor religious exemptions because they aren't covered by the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and that was published in October 12th of 2021. And Must Read Alaska, and there's like 86 comments on it, and I encourage all of you to read them all. They're very informative and substantive in nature, and I think it's time that we move past. You know, we're 50 years in, and we have an obligation to not only shareholders, but all people in Alaska to operate in a manner that is in tandem with state laws to protect Alaskans and Alaska Native people, shareholders, and tribal members, you know, that live and reside in Alaska, regardless of which tribe they belong to or which Native corporation. So I just think that we need to look at that, you know, and what are the roles of all these different organizations in this, in promoting civil rights? You know, it's just really confusing between the Alaska Federation of Natives, the Alaska Tribal Health Compact, First Alaskans Institute, you know, the, what is it called, the Polar Institute. You know, we need to clarify and spell out what our rights are, what we're allowed to do, and how we're allowed to impact others through the work that, you know, our organizations are doing. So that's all.
Ms. Boo, we have a question from Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. This is Representative Allard, and I agree. I remember that article, and I think part of the base of that article was that when we had loved ones in hospitals dying, what constitutes human rights and civil rights in order to be there for those individuals. So I think it was a breakthrough because that had happened, I believe, during COVID, if I'm not mistaken, ma'am, and the ability for loved ones to be with those that were in the hospital regardless of what issue, but they were literally on their last dying days. Is that the article you're referencing?
That is the article I'm referencing, but, you know, it just kind of brings to the point, you know, the lack of clarity we have and what we're allowed to do and not do. And I understand that might have been an overreaching special circumstance, but it still, you know, poses the question moving forward. And, you know, in my fellowship, when I found all the research, it was really heartbreaking, and I had PTSD over it, and you know, I've had to give myself a lot of grace and even move just to kind of try and recover a little bit. But, you know, we really need to review our impact that we have on people through all of these organizations, because they do have conflicting laws and people do have different interpretations. So I just really think it's important that, you know, if we're going to use the civil rights bill to move forward and like research the impact, you know, of civil rights issues in Alaska, I think that should be included. And I think that's an honest thing. I don't think it's like a politically charged thing. I think that's just where we're at.
Thank you, Ms. Bowie. Next, we're going to Karen Bernard out of the Anchorage LIO. Please state your name for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Hi, Karen Barnard, Anchorage. I was on my way home from the doctor and saw this, and the date it was introduced was the 26th. It's way too soon to have public testimony, so I'm not happy with this kind of doing our homework, handing in homework late. It's toward the end of the session, and as a voter, I'm not happy to see this. Now, the subject matter is very important. About the name change, it should include and civil rights. It should be the State Commission, the Alaska State Commission for Human and Civil Rights, and not remove human rights. It just opens up, removal of it just opens up too much abuse against various groups of people that are disliked. And I'm not seeing, it may be in the bill already, in the law rather, the seats on the board, there should be at least two for Alaska Natives. The governor gets to choose the board, and the legislators approve. The governor does not get to remove, only the legislature should be able to remove. We had a big fiasco with our amazing $81 billion moneymaker of the PFD, and she was run out of town through a maneuver, and that cannot happen. We lost somebody who, from what I could see, was not liked because she was assertive like a man, but she's a woman, so she's held to a different standard. So I was pretty disgusted to see that. The addition of, it's on line 11, page 1, the governor may remove a commissioner for cause. That's too ambiguous, and it allows too much funny business. And the situation shows that. That needs to be removed. Legislature should not be watered down. They're authority should not be watered down. That's how Hitler got into office, you know? He started watering down everything, removing checks and balances. You're the judiciary. You're in charge of keeping those checks and balances for us. You guys work really hard.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thing looks really technical, and it needs to have more public hearing because, you know, I don't even understand a lot of it.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Bunner.
Yeah, and you're missing the demographics.
Next, we have Zachary Goshtel, is the chairman of the State Commission for Human Rights. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, and for the members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Zachary Goshtel. I'm currently serving as the chairman of the State Commission for Human Rights, calling in support of HB 181, which essentially covering four main topics that have been essentially a significant success as the commission has passed four resolutions in the past 24 months unanimously covering the name change, our annual report date to Juneau essentially, nonprofit jurisdiction, and due process for removal of members of the committee. Very grateful for the opportunity to speak to you today, and I recognize that there are some additional edits that likely will come into this omnibus, but just for a few topics that I wish to present on the essential record, 1964, of course, Civil Rights Act of 1964 is really what we can, our commission verbiage from a title perspective falls under and based around. And human rights, as you well know, is not something that jurisdiction AS 1880 really puts on the commission. The significance here, changing the name to ensure that our fellow Alaskans have a better understanding of what the commission can do for them, focusing specifically on civil rights, civil liberties, is critical. it is oftentimes misunderstood that we are not here necessarily to specifically help with the human rights, and it's not the disinterest of the commission to do so. It is simply a statutory limitation. Changing that and moving to the next topic, where we talk specifically of the need to close a loophole within statute as it relates to nonprofit organizations. In the year 2018, we found that there's some data showing that there was over 5,700 nonprofits within the state of Alaska that constituted 44,000 employees. Those nonprofits generated approximately $3.9 billion of annual income. Those employees, all 44,000 of those employees, who are not able to receive support from the State Commission under its current statutory definition and the limitations that we have to provide jurisdiction over nonprofits. They do receive support from the Municipality of Anchorage, for instance. They can receive support at the federal level, but at the state level, we do not have the jurisdiction over them.
Mr. Goschel, I apologize. Your 2 minutes is up. I thank you for your testimony. We do have a question from Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the record, just wondering, Mr. Goschel, could you just describe your experience with the commission?
I was elected as chair and upon entry into the commission early 2022 and was just reelected as chair this past January as well. But essentially February, if I'm not mistaken, of 22 is when I became a member of this commission.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Allard also has a question.
Thank you. On the portion that you said the governor, whoever that governor may be, should have the ability to remove the commissioners, did you look at the line? I don't have the bill sitting in front of me, so I apologize. I think it's the portion where it says freedom of speech. Are you okay with the violation of a commissioner if they have a freedom of speech be violated and the governor could remove the person based on that?
I can thank you. Through the chair, we do have a few edits that have been recommended. I believe that is a portion of that we're making recommendations through our executive director. I don't know that I can speak specifically to that line, but I do believe that those edits are being discussed right now.
Can you follow up? Thank you. I know you have your executive director, but you guys, the director works for the commission. Are you speaking on the entire behalf of the commission? And who's actually making the decisions? You with the commissioners or your executive director?
The commission, of course, brings forth several resolutions. And in these cases, these resolutions have been unanimously voted upon. We ask that our executive director, of course, oftentimes be the voice of the commission as we're simply volunteers. And where there is topics of discussion, specifically even edits to recommendations to the legislation, I cannot speak on behalf of the commission until we've had the opportunity to discuss it within session. And so these edits are being pushed, and we're looking for the potential of having an in-session meeting to discuss any specific details. And so once we have done so, then we're able to more accurately and properly address the legislative branch.
Thank you. Mr. Gottschalk, through the chair, I have one last question. Is the director representing you, not representing you, but is he providing legal advice to make sure that this bill is as accurate as you'd like?
I would say carefully, yes. There is an advantage of our executive director having that legal background, but we also understand that the AG office does provide us with input as well as it relates to the legalities and the proper terminology. So we have the benefit of both offices, I think, when it comes to the resolution, the verbiage utilized in our resolution that we push forward to the legislative branch.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'd like that to be put on record that legal advice is being given when that is not allowed. Thank you.
Vice Chair Allard, I don't believe that that was the statement that Mr. Goschel had made.
But, thank you, Madam Chair.
We now have Jesse Ruppert, who is a commissioner on the Commission for Human Rights. Please state your name for the record and your affiliation. You have 2 minutes.
Yes, hello, and through the chair, this is Jesse Ruppert, commissioner on the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights. I am calling in support of HB 181. As a commissioner, I support this bill. In February, I was honored to get to meet with many of you in person, with the other commissioners, just to introduce myself and update you on the commission, as well as bring forward some of the legislative priorities that you do see here in the bill today. In regards to the name change, I was just going to speak. Often the commission is called for services that fall outside our jurisdiction. We as a commission do believe this happens because of the lack of clarity in its current name. I believe this bill clarifies and reflects the commission's purpose moving forward on all counts. The bill itself does need a tweak, as Chairperson Gottschall stated, based on updated nonprofit language that the Education Department sent to the chair on Wednesday morning. So, as you said, stated also, Chair, that's going on in providing affirmative protections for the religious employers and removing Section 3 because we just needed Section 4 for the annual report date change. So with the amendments done, I do support the overall intent and purpose for the bill. And I thank you, Chair Bass, and members of the committee for taking it just on behalf of the commission. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Ruffridge. Next, we have Mae Marsh, who's also a commissioner on the Commission for Human Rights. If you please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, my name is Mae Marsh, and I am currently serving as the vice chair of the State of Alaska Commission for Human Rights. I'm calling in support of HB 181, and it addresses four major changes that the commission has voted on and unanimously passed. The first one is the name change, because human rights is much broader than civil rights, and this brings it back to what our mission is and to where our jurisdiction is. The second is the report date, which puts it in, it syncs it with year-end dates, and it eliminates the necessary requirement of providing 40 hard copies. We're in a digital age now, and the commission did not believe that hard copies were needed. The third is to offer coverage to nonprofits, and I think that's already been gone over what those details are. And the final one is to provide due process if there is to be a removal of a commissioner. So thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Marsh. That concludes the... I forgot to open public testimony in the room. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide testimony on House Bill 181? Seeing none, I will now close public testimony. Thank you so much for those who testified on House Bill 181. For those listening online who did not have an opportunity to testify, you can email your written testimony to house.judiciary@akleg.gov, and it will be uploaded to the record. We will now set House Bill 181 aside. Additionally, I've added House Bill 11, Crime, Assault in the Presence of a Child, by Rep. Josephson, to next Friday's schedule, and I'm setting an amendment deadline for the bill for next Wednesday, May 3rd, by 5 p.m. I'm doing that so that we can have time and legal can have time to be able to make those considerations, because I know that they are quite busy. That concludes our business for today. The House Judiciary Committee will meet again on Monday, May 1st at 1 p.m. to have a hearing on House Bill 129, voter registration, by this House Judiciary Committee in its first hearing. And then we will also hear House Bill 105, sex reproduction education schools, in its first hearing by the governor as presented by the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect it is 2:19 p.m.